From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. So how is the dust settling after yesterday's elections? Democrats won big. Does that mean Donald Trump lost? In Virginia, the Democrat Ralph Northam beat former GOP party chair and President Trump's endorsed candidate, Ed Gillespie. Here's Northam last night.
Today, Virginians have answered and have spoken. Virginia has told us to end the divisiveness, that we will not condone hatred and bigotry, and to end the politics that have torn this country apart.
Let's bring in NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there, Robin.
So start with Ed Gillespie losing. You know, he worked with more moderate Republicans when he was GOP chair and people like the Bushes. When he ran here in Virginia, he embraced policies more to the right. He condemned sanctuary cities, even though there aren't any in the state. What happened? Did he go too far to the right for the moderate Republicans, but maybe not far enough for Trump fans? What happened?
Well, Virginia has trended way more Democratic over the last 13 years since President Bush was reelected and won the state. But, you know, you've had Barack Obama win it twice. You had Hillary Clinton win it. Remember that. You know, this is, while Virginia looks like the rest of the country, this is still a state that Hillary Clinton won. So Ed Gillespie had a very difficult time trying to figure out how to play the Trump message. He tried to walk this line, but he went very strongly into some of these cultural issues, hoping that he would, get a boost from some of those Trump supporters, and it just didn't work.
Well, given what you just said, you know, what the state has been doing, how it's been trending, how did they misplay that? Because this was an important race for some sort of statement about the Trump presidency, which is just a year old now.
Yeah. Well, I think that what's happened here now is that big picture, the lines are sort of redrawn back to where they were before the 2016 election. In other words, you know, if Trump and Trumpism, if people who supported President Trump thought that they were going to be able to expand with President Trump's message, even though he has record low approval ratings, that is just not the case. If you're a Republican and you see what happened in Virginia last night, to a lesser extent in New Jersey, but not, you know, unconsequentially, the Virginia House of Delegates, which Democrats nearly took over last night. If you're a Republican watching that and you represent the suburbs or a moderate to Democratic-leaning state, that's a big, big warning sign that you can't really run with President Trump.
You know, so interesting. I just said we want to move to New Jersey, but it's so interesting you say that because in following you and hearing others speak last night, there was this sense that this was a who jumps in. And if you're going to jump in, how do you jump in? But does that really play across the rest of the country?
Well, I think that that's a difficult thing for Democrats. Like, they have to be able to sit there and look at the results. Of course, they feel good about where they were. They're going to hit a reset button and be able to look at maybe an affirmative message going forward. But it doesn't necessarily mean that they can win with the same kind of message that they were able to run on in this race and run and win in places that they need to win that they lost in 2016. So I think we're at a reset point. Democrats at least are off the mat, as I heard Terry McAuliffe, the Democratic governor in Virginia, say, because if they had lost last night in Virginia in particular, it would have been an absolute bloodbath and finger pointing within the party.
Yeah, and conversely, if Gillespie had won, there are a lot of Republicans sitting on the sidelines who would have said, I'm going to try that, too. You
sure.
know, just go a little more, which, you know, makes politicians sound really bad, you know, that they would just go towards.
Well, everyone's testing out
yeah.
what works and what doesn't.
Yeah. Let's look at New Jersey. A Democrat won there, Phil Murphy. But this is a state that, you know, I mean, Chris Christie, 8-year reign, but incredibly unpopular at this point.
Oh, yeah. I think it was a total uphill battle for Kim Guadagno, as she says her name, because she's got the GN on the end, so a lot of Italians will say Guadagno, but whatever. She says Guadagno. And
remember, you're a Montanaro. Okay, go ahead.
I know. So Murphy wins this race. He was an Obama fundraiser. He was very much expected to win, and Chris Christie did put his lieutenant governor in a hole there, given he was one of the least approved of governors in the country after the Bridgegate scandal that closed a couple of lanes politically. And you also had in New Jersey an interesting race in Hoboken, New Jersey, actually where I used to live, where the city got its first Sikh mayor. And he was really subject to some racist attacks that showed a poster of him saying that don't let terrorism take over our town. And it is a place that has been changing demographically and is right outside New York City. And he won and had a unifying message at the end of the night. So again, Democratic progressive values went out in a place where they can and should.
Yeah. So I want to take a listen to what the Republicans are saying. Here's Rona McDaniel, the chair of the Republican National Committee and Mitt Romney's niece. She was on Fox News today. Here's a bit of what she had to say.
We're back to status quo. Republicans won five special elections, including Utah last night, that they should have won. And Democrats won two governorships that they should have won. So nothing really changed. They're going to try and create this big narrative. They should have won Virginia. They should have won New Jersey. But what we are seeing is that voters across this country want to see things get done in Washington.
Is she right?
Well, it points to a close 2018 midterm election and a potentially close 2020 election. Now, you shouldn't overread the results of one election night. But I think what she's saying there isn't terribly wrong, but it does hurt Republicans' chances of recruiting people because the momentum would have been much more on their side had they won last night. Even anywhere. Instead, what's happened is that Democrats had a much better night. And she's the only place where she's wrong is the fact that there were so many down ballot pickups for Democrats in Virginia, for example.
Real quick, we have a minute. Maine became the first state to expand Medicaid through a ballot initiative. This is a huge rebuke to their Republican Governor Paula Page. But what does it say about Medicaid expansion? Is this something people want?
You're going to see this picked up in a lot of other parts of the country. And if Democrats do wind up taking back that house, for example, in Virginia, you're going to see the Democratic governor try to expand Medicaid, something that had been stopped by the Democratic governor. So this may be a new tack by progressives to be able to try to expand Obamacare and keep it in place.
Yeah. Domenica Montanaro, lead politics editor at NPR. We should note it was a good election day for women. Many more
it
running.
It was up and down. Yeah. A lot of mayor's races.
Yeah. Especially after, the Trump election. There was a concerted effort to get women in office. Seemed to work yesterday. Domenico, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Iraq's Supreme Federal Court ruled this week that no region can secede, a clear message to the Kurds who voted for independence in September. Iraq's Kurdistan region for years has been seen as the most stable and prosperous part of Iraq, the region that flourished under a U.S. no-fly zone in the 90s, more recently expanded its territory after Kurdish forces stood up to ISIS. Then came that referendum on independence. NPR's Jaina Raff reports from Erbil.
There were hundreds of people gathered outside parliament the day after Kurdish President Masoud Barzani resigned last month. They were distraught. Demonstrators couldn't imagine a Kurdistan region without the man who has led it for the past 12 years. Barzani stepped down after pushing through a vote for Kurdish independence when the U.S. and his other allies had warned him not to. Iraq retaliated by retaking territory from the Kurds. Diana Hussein is a Syrian Kurdish refugee. She skipped a high school exam to join the rally. To her, Barzani is a father figure.
We just want Masoud Barzani. He's our president. He's our dad. We will die for Masoud Barzani, for Kurdistan.
She starts to cry.
No one hear us. We're going to die without him.
Syria also has a large Kurdish population. A lot of them revere Barzani because he sent his forces to fight for Syrian Kurdish cities. To many Kurds, this is an existential crisis. Not just the end for now of their dreams of independence, but a fear that Iraqi forces won't stop until they reach the Kurdish capital. They've already taken the city of Kirkuk and oil fields. Iraqi forces have taken over border crossings with Turkey and Syria the Kurds have controlled since the 1990s. And their economy is in tatters.
This was our plan to revitalize the economy in Kurdistan.
Qubad Talabani is the deputy prime minister of the Kurdistan region. He's sitting in his office with a flowchart behind him. Before the referendum, he was trying to reform the Kurdish economy. But now there's almost no money coming in at all. They can't even pay salaries. And the Iraqi government has made clear that it holds almost all the cards.
We've lost territory. We've lost strategic assets, oil assets, and we've also, for now, lost some of the support that we had from the international community. Now, we're hoping that that part is temporary.
Talabani for years was the Kurdish government's representative in Washington. The Kurdish leadership, in holding the vote, gambled the U.S. would feel it owed the Kurds after their fighters fought and died battling ISIS. But it proved more important to the United States that Iraq stay intact.
And this question brought together an unbelievable alliance: Iraq, Iran, Turkey, the UN, the EU, the Arab League, the US, the UK, France, Germany. It brought all of these countries together in opposition.
Talabani wasn't the strongest supporter of the referendum, but he didn't publicly oppose it. Now he's trying to pick up the pieces. He says they want to talk to the Iraqi government, but Baghdad has made clear it will continue to squeeze the Kurds, and it's not picking up the phone. Jaina Raff, NPR News, Erbil.
For 8 years, Pete Souza had total access to President Obama as his chief official White House photographer. He was in top secret meetings as well as family moments. Now he's published a collection of his photographs in the book Obama, An Intimate Portrait. And Pete Souza joins us to talk about it. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me on.
And the first time that you photographed President Obama was before he was president. You've got the photo in the book. You were at the Chicago Tribune, and he was a senator from Illinois. Do you think that you would have become his photographer if it hadn't been for that connection?
No, absolutely not. That's how I met him. I was based in the Tribune's Washington, D.C. bureau, and Jeff Zeleny, who was a correspondent in the bureau, came up with this idea of doing a documentary look at Obama's first year in the Senate, and he mentioned to me, and I said, I'm in for this. So I got to know him that first year in 2005, and then subsequently continued to cover him as a senator and went on a couple of foreign trips with him and covered the start of his presidential campaign. So without that relationship, I never would have gotten this job.
How different was it to take pictures of him then than when he was in the White House?
Well, the apparatus that follows him was not the same. I mean, I remember we went to Moscow on a trip. He went with Richard Lugar, senator from Indiana, the two of them on a congressional delegation, and Jeff and I went along. And we were in Red Square with one security guy from the State Department, and not a single person in Red Square recognized him. Those days are gone.
Is it different to take a photo of somebody who is being recognized by everybody around them versus somebody who's kind of anonymous to the surroundings?
Just the logistics are difficult to maneuver. I was consciously, that first trip to Moscow in 2005, I was consciously trying to show people ignoring him because I thought, you know, someday this guy may become president. Mm. And you're never going to have this scene again where he's going to be in such an open public space where no one even knows who he is. Of course, you know, once anyone becomes president, everyone is focused on that person, and just the situation is completely different.
Well, once he became president, you very quickly said, I want to have all access. I want to be everywhere that he is. Was there precedent for that, and was it difficult to get that access?
My model of a White House photographer was Yoshi Okamoto, who was LBJ's photographer. I never knew Yoshi, but Yoshi was really the first White House photographer to truly document a president for history. And his pictures are just so good. His access was so good. He set the bar so high that I think every subsequent official White House photographer has been trying to reach his bar. So that was my model. President Obama understood that, and he acceded to my request. But of course, once you step inside the Oval Office, things change. And if you can imagine every day somebody following you around, taking pictures all day, every day, it takes a little getting used to. And then you have other people that are worried about what they're saying to the president. Here's this, you know, what they consider an observer in the room. So that took a few months to sort of get people accustomed to me being in every meeting, you know, every day, whether it was a domestic policy meeting or a national security meeting. But I think after the first few months, I think people recognized that I took what I did seriously, that I was not going to ever leak anything, that I was really trying to document his presidency for history.
Did they ever kick you out of a meeting? Did they say, this is too sensitive, Pete, can you please step outside?
Not that I can recall. I think the one time where I tried to give him some space was if he was having a one-on-one meeting, meaning there was just him and one other person. I would get the shots that I needed and then just quietly back out of the room. I wasn't kicked out, but I knew that he wanted it to be a private meeting, and mostly for the sake of his guest, I knew that it was better to give him some privacy in meetings like that.
When you did stay in meetings, did you listen to what was going on, or were you able to just tune it out and focus on the photographs?
I didn't tune it out totally, because you sort of want to get the broad sweep of what's going on, because that helps you capture the right moment, the right mood. Maybe there's a certain individual in the meeting that you should be focusing on other than the president, you know, depending on the subject matter. So although I couldn't, you know, relay in detail what anyone was saying, I needed to have an idea of what the essence of this meeting was about to help my photography and help create, you know, meaningful pictures.
You and I have met once before, and it was a few years ago when we were both given an award at Boston University. And I remember being told that you were flying in and flying out that very day because you didn't want to miss one day of taking photographs of President Obama. Tell us about that. And did you ever have to miss an extended period of time?
So the first 5 years, I did not take a vacation. And then the last 3 years, I took 1 week each year. Otherwise, my wife would have killed me. So those were the only times I took off. I also took one sick day in 8 years, and that was only because I had to go undergo anesthesia to have a colonoscopy. So they did not let me come to work.
What were you so afraid of missing?
History, right? When you're documenting history, you don't really know all the time when it's going to take place. So I was always nervous about missing something.
You write that there were moments when you had to hide your own tears behind the camera while you were taking photos. What was one of those?
Well, Newtown. After the mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School, 2 days later, we went to Newtown, and the emotions were still raw. You can imagine you're a parent. You sent your six-year-old, your first grader, off to school, and they never come home because some crazy guy shot them to death. There were 20 parents that happened to. And we went to Newtown 2 days after what for them was the worst day of their life. And just the emotion of him meeting with these families privately for hours before the public memorial service was just too much to bear.
He said that was the worst day of his presidency.
He does say that. I think his reaction to this tragedy was felt not just as a president, but as a fellow parent.
You've also got a few photos in this book of somebody named Corey Remsburg, who the president met. And then later, Corey Remsburg was severely injured in Afghanistan. Tell us about that and why you decided to include so many photos with Corey Remsburg.
Corey, I've gotten to know him and his dad a little bit. Well, the president would go to Walter Reed usually every 3 months. I think he went 24 or 25 times during his administration to see injured soldiers coming back from Afghanistan or Iraq. And in 2010, we walked into Corey's room, and here he was lying on the bed. He had just dozens of stitches across his head, the side of his head. He had been severely injured. It was hard to look at in some ways. And his dad was there, and his dad said, "Well, you, Mr. President, you've met Corey before. You met him 8 months before in Normandy in June 6, 2009. And I'm listening to this, and I'm trying to, like, remember this, and I can't. But then Craig, his dad, had taped to the hospital wall a photo that I had taken of President Obama shaking hands with Army Ranger Corey Rendsburg on June 6, 2009 in Normandy. And I'm looking at this photograph and then looking at Corey in the bed, and I'm thinking, like, oh, my gosh, this is hard to fathom, hard to take in. It was the only time that he had met someone who then subsequently was injured like this in Afghanistan or Iraq. And I, you know, I had doubts whether Corey would recover, but he did. And a couple years later, he was invited as a guest of honor at the State of the Union address. He sat next to Michelle Obama, and a woman at the New York Times wanted to do a story about Corey. And that was the first time that we had allowed those pictures to be made public at Corey's request. He wanted people to see the progress that he had made, and he thought he could be an example for other wounded soldiers, that no matter how bad you're injured, that you can come back. And Corey is proof of that.
That's Pete Souza. His book is called Obama, An Intimate Portrait. We'll continue our conversation tomorrow and ask about Souza's Instagram feed, which has been biting in its criticism of President Trump.
I think I have been respectful, playful, subtle, and compared to the comments I make on Instagram, they pale in comparison to what some people write on Twitter, for instance.
That's tomorrow on Here and Now, and you can see some of Pete Souza's photos at hereandnow.org.
Stock markets rallied to record highs again this week in the U.S. and abroad. CNBC reports that most major global markets are up double digits. The S&P and the Dow recorded an eighth consecutive week of gains last week. In general, U.S. stocks have jumped more than 20% in the past year. The Nikkei in Japan closed at its highest level yesterday since 1992. President Trump is taking credit. He tweeted yesterday, "Stock market hit yet another all-time record high. There is great confidence in the moves that my administration is making, working very hard on tax cuts for the middle class, companies and jobs." But investors say things are a little more complicated than that. Joining us is Robin Farzad, host of Full Disclosure on NPR One. Welcome, the other Robin. Hi.
Hi, Robin.
Look, can't Donald Trump say, you know, that he has something to do with this? You can see investors thinking, well, there's going to be, you know, fewer regulations. There's going to be tax cuts. It's going to be good for business.
Look, Donald Trump, if he could, he would take credit for photosynthesis, or, you know, he'd claim that he shot JR. God bless him. But this is only marginally about the presidential administration, as it was with Barack Obama, who, by the way, had, I think, a better performing stock market than Ronald Reagan. The thing is, it's been all about the Fed. It's been all about cheap money now, almost for 10 years. And people have been piling into risk assets here in the United States and pretty much everywhere else across the planet.
Take that a little broader for people maybe just listening in for this kind of, you know, information. When you say the Fed, lower interest rates, it's easier to, you know, borrow money?
Yeah, I'm looking at the Wall Street Journal. The Fed funds rate target is 1 to 1.25%. And look, before the financial crisis, we were in the 4% range, where we're talking about interest rates broadly. How that translates is, if I'm looking to get a money market yield in a bank, it's still at about 0.3%. It's pennies. CDs, maybe a five-year CD will pay me a point and a half. That's nothing. So ergo, if I want return, I have to go out and chase yield. I have to chase riskier assets, be it real estate investing, be it gold, oil, Bitcoin. Many people have plowed into the U.S. stock market because they perceive that you're getting the quality of earnings and American transparency and dividends, and plus they have a boatload of cash that they could return to shareholders.
Okay, well, that's the U.S., but what about – why are global markets doing so well right now?
Because global monetary policy has also been on kind of max. If you look at the European crisis, which peaked in 2010 and 2011, interest rates are really low over there. Some countries have negative interest rates to keep people out of cash at any cost. So when the United States opportunity has kind of been maxed out, people go seeking opportunities in emerging markets, in developed markets, even giving countries like Greece and Spain and Ireland time of day again. Yeah.
Okay, so we're always told what goes up must come down, and don't look. You know, don't look at your statements. Just be prepared because there's always a crash after this kind of growth. What's your sense?
You know, I have to sit my kid on my lap and say, you know, back in my day, son, we had things called corrections and pullbacks and crashes. We haven't known anything like that now for how long has it been? 2011. Six, 7 years,
yeah.
Things do fall apart, and not just out of calamity, but really the pause that refreshes a 10% or a 15% pullback. This, what's called a market melt up, has been so relentless that people, so many people have been lulled into this sense of security that things can only go up, and that's new paradigm thinking, and that's so fraught with risk.
Exactly. Things come down. Robin Farzad, host of Full Disclosure on NPR One. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
It'll be months before we find out which city Amazon will choose to be the site of its second headquarters. The announcement of the company's search drew 238 bids from cities across the country, including Kansas City. Last month, we visited Kansas City and looked at a different bid it made more than 7 years ago to become the first site of a new ultra-fast internet and TV service called Google Fiber.
It was a pretty big deal, right? This was Google's first foray into providing a service that is traditionally in a lot of parts of the country. You have one or two providers and everyone more or less hates them.
Mark Bergen covers Google and its parent company Alphabet for Bloomberg, and he remembers the excitement around fiber's potential when compared to internet services like Comcast and Verizon.
You know, you had slow speeds, poor service, high prices, and Google had promised good service, slow prices, and like unheard of speeds for internet.
And what was in it for Google to do this?
I think the worst case scenario for Google was that they spent a lot of money to get the competitors and telcos and cable to speed up their service and lower prices. And, you know, the big picture, Google wins when more people are online. It wins when more people are using the internet more frequently. Google saw this as a lucrative business that they thought they could transform with technology and build out some revenue beyond advertising.
Fiber and its speed were relatively new for everyday consumers. With the service, you could download a full-length movie in just a minute. In 2010, Google announced its search for the first fiber city, and more than 1,000 applications poured in.
We are convinced that Shreveport is an ideal place for Google to test its fiber project.
Please support Duluth's nomination for Google Fiber.
At the end of the day, Austin Public Schools is a great place to educate kids, and we could certainly use the support of Google.
There is no doubt in my mind that Baltimore is the best city in America to invest in new fiber internet infrastructure.
Fresno wants Google Fiber.
Topeka, Kansas temporarily renamed itself Google with the hope of attracting the company. But the win went just next door to Kansas City. So what does the startup industry look like in Kansas City? Well, in the neighborhood of Westport, Matthew Marcus took us on a tour of one of Kansas City's new tech-focused co-working spaces, a 160,000-square-foot renovated high school. Marcus is executive director of the Kansas City Startup Foundation.
But you can see, like, they kept the lockers, and some of the lockers have power ports. So you could literally just sit there, plug in, and,
oh, cool.
And work in a hallway like back in high school.
And, of course, a ping pong table down there.
You got to have ping pong. That's the way to go.
Marcus says there's no question that Google Fiber had a positive impact on the city's tech industry.
When I look back at 2010, you know, Kansas City had startups and entrepreneurs like any other city, but it was pretty quiet. The startup community wasn't very cohesive. And then it was like a few things took place in our city, one of which was Google choosing, you know, Kansas City to bring their fiber service. And it just kind of helped to cultivate this energy that was already starting to pick up.
Why is it so great to have Google Fiber, though? What is the big deal?
Honestly, a lot of people thought it would be the speed. Wow, we can download things faster. Videos will show quicker. There'll be no more lag or spinning wheels anymore. And sure, that happened. But honestly, I think it was more about just, hey, here's a cool service that came to Kansas City. Entrepreneurs are gathering around it to try to put it to use for their businesses. And it just kind of started to breed out into other meetup groups, other initiatives, events that popped up just because of that excitement.
How big is the startup community in Kansas City?
I'll say that we like to classify several things as BGF and AGF, before Google Fiber and after Google Fiber. Kind of strange, but and you know, we're not Silicon Valley, we're not Austin, we're not Denver yet, but we're also not Podunk, Flyover, Cowtown, either.
In the last 4 years, first-time employers, many of them startups, added 84,000 jobs to the city, according to the data firm KC SourceLink. Available investment capital has increased 290%. New tech businesses have sprung up, offering online marketplaces, farming analytics, pet data, public finance systems, athlete-only social media networks, and plenty of others. But in Kansas City, fiber isn't just for the tech industry. Schools and other public services adopted Google Fiber, and so did everyday residents. Kerry Coogan is deputy director of the Kansas City Public Library and chairs the Kansas City Coalition for Digital Inclusion.
One of the things that I think is really interesting about when Google Fiber came to town is the way that they rolled it out. And I think even they would say that it was a learning experience because you had to have every person in the neighborhood sign up. They were called Fiberhoods. Mm-hmm. And you had to pay to sign up to get access. And if a certain percentage signed up, then you got to have Google Fiber in your neighborhood. But in a lot of the neighborhoods on the east side in Kansas City, they didn't sign up.
Coogan says Google Fiber's rollout highlighted the city's so-called digital divide. While wealthier neighborhoods were quick to put the money down, poorer ones didn't, which meant no fiber and in some places, no internet at all.
We went out into these communities and helped people get signed up, paid the initial cost to get signed up so that those core neighborhoods would get the fiber that they needed.
And did they?
They did. They did. Yeah. So, and I think Google even recognized that, you know, we need to make sure that we're understanding the neighborhoods and the cities that we go into and how we can help everyone and make sure that they have access.
So what kind of a difference has Google Fiber made in those neighborhoods?
Number one is that they created a lot of competition. A lot of the other providers here realized that Google Fiber coming in with different plans and lower base plans, they had to step up and offer some of the same things. So I think there's been a lot of opportunity in terms of competition. But the other thing that Google Fiber did very well, I think, from the library's perspective in these communities is they opened up a digital inclusion fund and they offered grant opportunities for nonprofits who are providing the service. They also offered two full-time staff members for they're called Google Digital Inclusion Fellows, to work solely on digital inclusion initiatives at the library and also at other nonprofits in the city. So what's important about that is that they really listened to the things that people in the digital divide and the people working in the digital divide needed, which is people and resources. And yes, it's partly a business decision, but it's also sort of a moral question, too. Are we going to help these people that need it?
Some Kansas City residents still have no access. According to a 2016 survey, only 56% of Kansas City households making less than $30,000 a year had access to the internet at home. Compare that to 91% of other households. But as Kerry Coogan points out, the library is connected and full of people making use of Google Fiber.
A lot of books in this library, of course, but the people in this library right now, at this moment, are on computers.
That's right. And I think you'll find it if you go into almost any library across the nation is that the 21st century library has to have computer access for people that desperately need it.
What do you think it would be like here if Google Fiber had never come?
I think that we would still be doing a lot of this work because the library has been doing digital inclusion work since computers ever came about. But I don't think it would have happened as quickly. I think that we were all looking for ways to capitalize on what this could mean, bringing Google Fiber here. And so I think that we were way ahead of the game, and a lot of other communities and neighborhoods now are just understanding or don't realize that they have people that don't have access or that they don't know how to use a computer, even when you have to apply for every single job you have using the computer. So I think it pushed us way ahead of people across the country.
Would you recommend to another city or town to say, yes, we want Google Fiber?
Yes, I would. But I think it also has been, as much as it's been a learning experience for Kansas City and the nonprofits and everybody who's had access to Google Fiber, I think it's also been a learning lesson for them. I hope that they will continue to understand that they need to look at the entire city, even the people who don't have connectivity, and find ways to help them going forward.
Nationally, there's speculation that Google Fiber is foundering. It's lost multiple executives, including two CEOs in the last year. There were layoffs, and plans to expand fiber to eight other cities came to a halt. In Kansas City, expansion also seems to be on hold. I asked Bloomberg reporter Mark Bergen about that.
In some ways, it's like a shortcoming of Silicon Valley's utopian dream and their vision, right? This world-class internet company, Google, solving a very old-fashioned problem in a very old-fashioned industry and promising to shake it up. And I do think that, you know, the leaders at Alphabet are still imagining a world in which they want to deliver internet to every corner of the world. They want to find some sort of, you know, magic wand technological solution. They're clearly the smart people working on technologies that we've never heard of around this. But digging up backyards is not something they're committed to anymore.
Whatever happens with Google Fiber, Kansas City will always have the benefit of getting it first, a stamp of approval from Silicon Valley. And like almost every city in America, Kansas City is hoping for another stamp from Amazon. We've got photos from our visit to Kansas City's tech community at hereandnow.org.
Country music hosts its biggest annual award show tonight, but 50 years ago, Nashville was celebrating a very different event when the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum first opened its doors. And as Jason Moon Wilkins from WPLN reports, the hall may have never made it to year one without the unlikely leadership of two women in an industry dominated by men.
In 1967, men were entrenched at the top of the country charts. Even an artist who would go on to become an icon had to start with a novelty song about stereotypes.
Just because I'm blonde, don't think I'm dumb, 'cause this dumb blonde ain't nobody's home.
Dolly Parton's first solo single was a minor hit, but she would go on to a major career that would later find her inducted into the Hall of Fame. The year that song was released, the institution opened its museum. And two women, unknown to anyone outside the industry, were featured in an hour-long opening night telecast.
Mrs. Frances Preston and Mrs. Joe Walker.
Frances Preston and Joe Walker were key to bringing the museum to life. But even on the night celebrating their accomplishments, they were still treated with a mixture of respect and condescension.
Right now, because you're going to be a busy girl throughout the evening, because there are lots of top stars here, and you'll be talking to the writers and the stars.
That busy girl was the Nashville vice president for BMI, one of the most important music companies in the world, and by all accounts, the driving force that made sure the doors were paid for, much less opened that night. The other woman, whose work was just as important, but who remained more in the background, was Joe Walker. That evening, while Preston stood out front wearing a ball gown and a sky-high bouffant, Walker appeared on screen in a jacket, introducing items from the artifacts case.
A banjo of Burl Ives, a banjo of Earl Scruggs, the original auto harp used by Sarah Carter of the original Carter family.
Walker was the head of the relatively young Country Music Association, which helped create the museum. She started as an assistant at the CMA and never imagined she would run the association just 10 months later when the original director walked away. As she remembered in a 1996 interview, she assumed they would hire another man.
That's what they said they were going to do. We're looking for a man. I mean, that's the way they put it.
But you said you didn't particularly...
I didn't think anything about that at all.
It's just the way it was.
Mm-hmm.
But another influential woman in country music suggested that Walker should run the show.
Miss Minnie Pearl.
Howdy! I'm just so proud to be here.
I was told by someone it was Minnie Pearl who said to the board in a discussion about it, why are we looking for someone else? Why don't we just make Joe the executive director? She's doing all the work anyway. And everybody said, well, why not?
One of the first big projects Walker had to take on was establishing the museum. It was an idea born from the 1964 World's Fair in New York. They had requested a country music exhibit. that Frances Preston had drawn up in the shape of a guitar, but she and others paused that plan and decided instead to build a more permanent place in Nashville. Joe Walker said that support was sometimes lacking from the business community back home.
You know, it was pretty difficult to get the city fathers in those early days of CMA to, they thought of us as more or less kind of a bunch of unwashed hillbillies out here on Music Row.
But Walker said that Preston was known for twisting influential arms and squeezing money, even from some in the city, who saw the genre as an embarrassment. The museum's longtime CEO, Kyle Young, says that role continued long after her work with the Hall of Fame.
As we're sitting here now and we're seeing the city just flourish, and it's the It City and so on and so forth, it's hard to think of anyone who had more impact than Frances on not only developing the industry, but also connecting the industry to the community.
From the beginning of her career, Preston was recognized as a business trailblazer, but she did not see herself as part of the women's liberation movement of the time. In an interview from 1974, Preston refused to believe women were limited by glass ceilings or closed executive doors.
I have not found that a door has been closed to me because I was a woman, and I started out long before a lot of other people decided that doors were closed to them. I think being a woman, I got the door open, but if I had not been a business person and had not known what I was doing, I couldn't have kept the door open.
Over her career, Preston would help turn royalty collection giant BMI into one of Nashville's biggest employers. She herself was inducted into the Hall in 1992 and died a decade later. Walker went on to lead the Country Music Association for nearly 30 years. Later known as Joe Walker Metter, she established the CMA's long-running award show and helped build the CMA Fest. She passed away this summer at the age of 93. On that opening night telecast in 1967, Walker made what would turn out to be a modest prediction.
We expect thousands of people to come through the museum each year. And one of the
greatest. Last year, at its current downtown location, nearly 1.2 million people walked through the doors Frances Preston and Joe Walker Metter helped open 50 years ago. For Here and Now, I'm Jason Moon Wilkins in Nashville.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.